Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The federal shutdown stretches on, officially becoming the longest shutdown in U.S. history. Plus, State Superintendent Jill Underlie appears before a Senate committee after a report about sexual misconduct in schools. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court agrees to hear a case about race-based college scholarships. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for November 7th. I'm Ani Van Wagendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. Quite a week that we have had, a lot of twists and turns along the way, starting with the sort of ongoing backlash from this investigation into DPI and the sort of the way that they have handled accusations of misconduct in the past. So Jill Underlie this week called that a partisan sort of investigation, calls for her resignation as politicking, and then she testified before the Senate Education Committee. But one of the things that she unveiled is that there is now a sort of online resource to show where educator licenses have been suspended or revoked. And so then at this committee hearing, GOP lawmakers said, well, you've been saying that you don't have the resources for this kind of thing. You've unveiled a new resource without additional money. So we'll start just by taking a little bit of a look at that committee hearing.
I appreciate your reaction and your recommendations, but never has anyone, yourself or anyone from the Department of Public Instruction, come to us, never went to the ranking member, never went to the chair of education, never went to members of finance and said, hey, this is a priority. We got to fix this. You know, shouldn't we be doing all we can? That's where the frustration level is. So you say we're making political points or people are making political hay. My frustration is the legislature is getting blamed for stuff, and now you're able to make some counteractions and make some recommendations, which is great, but where was all this before the article ran?
I have never been invited to testify to joint finance. We put forward these budgets, and including, you know, ways to modernize our system or to add positions to the department. I think that there is some, you know, political stuff here at play. I feel like I've been trying to advocate for these resources the past 5 years, and even before that when I was in a school district. I think we can do a lot of good work together. I really do. I think that, you know, like I said, school safety, and you agree, it's not political.
So just a lot of discussion about what of this is politics, what of this is about sort of protecting children. What do you make of that whole committee hearing?
Well, of course there's politics at play. I mean, it always is in the Capitol. Democrats, generally speaking, have an advantage polling-wise in terms of education. So Republicans see an opportunity here to kind of knock back that advantage by saying, look, here's your leaders at DPI, backed by the Democratic Party of Wisconsin in her election in 2025, doing this. Like, what's going on? Your reading scores aren't doing well. What is going on? So there's that. Same time, if it were purely political and there wasn't a problem at all, why are you introducing a new resource to track these things and be more open what's going on? So there's that. Also have to mention a really interesting exchange with Underlie, because she had two committees this week, you know, education and joint audit. Joint audit was going over the MPS, Milwaukee Public Schools audit. So remember, MPS failed to file these financial reports with the state in time. There's all kinds of like back and forth about this. The governor called for a review. The audit was approved. I didn't show up for that part of the hearing. Now, she came for the grooming part of it, but not for that. And they're like, what's going on? Like, you guys are in charge of this stuff, and you're not here. And the answer to DPI was, well, you don't get the governor for everything. Like, you know, you get agency heads, but not the governor, so why would she be here? And it was kind of like, wait a second, time out. Not the greatest response politically to what's going on, not helping herself with Republicans, but still, she showed up, answered their questions, has a new resource. We'll see where it goes from here, like what the next steps are. But it's been a rough spot for Superintendent Underlie. Question is, again, what gets her out of this or gets this to quiet down eventually?
One of the things that's coming out of this is a couple of proposed pieces of legislation, one of which is a proposal to make grooming a felony offense. And I believe she told you she's given it a passing glance but hasn't kind of like commented on that legislation. So that'll also be interesting to see, is just the legislative response to this as it kind of continues to unfold.
And we're going to get more of a definition of whether grooming is actually already covered. So remember, with this assembly committee. They voted to ask the assembly organization committee to ask the attorney general, hey, can you look at like our current moral standards for teachers? Is grooming covered? That committee voted this week to approve that request. They have to draft the letter and all the proper language in it. So eventually we might get a word from Josh Call of, okay, is grooming already covered in what we have these standards for teachers?
Yes, and we'll continue to kind of see this unfold. And it'll also be interesting to see, as you mentioned, sort of where the Democrats land on this. We've seen Democrats with some harsh words for Underley, but then also some coming to her defense during these committee hearings. One described this as kind of a witch hunt. And so, again, this kind of politicized moment while also dealing with this very real issue of misconduct in schools. So lots to pay attention to there. And then, of course, the kind of other big news of the week is the shutdown has officially set the record for the longest federal government shutdown in history. Among all of that has been this question of what's going to go on with SNAP payments. And so over the weekend, what we thought was kind of the big news for a little while was that the governor declared a state of emergency. It was a little unclear what that would actually do, but it was, you know, Evers kind of, I think, trying to make a forceful statement at a time that the legislature and the governor weren't necessarily going to, you know, come together to pass any kind of emergency spending bill, whatever. There was some protection in there for around price gouging. So that happened over the weekend. Then DHS issued this, what I found to be kind of confusing guidance about what exactly SNAP recipients could expect, which was essentially delays of weeks to months in terms of receiving SNAP payments while there were all these changes to the vendor system, and the federal government said that only partial payments would come out. So that came out. And then yesterday, a federal judge around 5 p.m. Said that actually the Trump administration needed to pay everything in full by today. And a few hours later, Evers comes out with a statement saying that SNAP recipients will receive their full November payments today. One SNAP recipient that I spoke to this morning said he has, in fact, received his payments. And so I think we'll all be checking in to see to what extent that actually kind of plays out. There, again, might be some bureaucratic snafus with vendors and things like that. But so far, it does seem like those wheels are on the bus for now.
Well, also the legal fight. So remember, the federal judge first said you guys have to fund these payments. President Trump put a statement on Truth Social saying basically we're going to fund them once the Democrats reopen the government. So that was kind of, wait a second, what's happening with that? It was going to be a partial payment, I think 65% number I saw in a couple national stories. Then the judge says no full payment. Now the caveat is the Trump administration is already moving for an appeal, emergency appeal, I believe. So what I'm wondering, and not a lawyer, as I always stress, so if there's a stay issued today at 5 o'clock, what's that mean for SNAP recipients? If you don't have your money, are you not going to get it? If you have it, can they take it away? Like, it, once the money's out, what's the recourse there? So something to watch of just what this legal battle is going to do and how it impacts SNAP recipients in Wisconsin and elsewhere.
Yeah, I think one of the things that DHS guidance, again, from earlier that maybe doesn't apply anymore, but made really clear is that there's this very complex system to kind of administer these types of benefits. And so really abrupt changes can kind of set everything into chaos. And so there's just all of these things that are always in play and then and that are maybe taken for granted to kind of administer these types of programs. And then chaos can kind of ensue relatively quickly. The other kind of interesting thing coming out of the shutdown is that Senator Ron Johnson has said that he will support ending the filibuster in the Senate. This is a sort of flip-flop from a position that he took in 2022 when it was Democrats who wanted to end the filibuster for sort of their own purposes. So, of course, this is kind of often something that happens during shutdowns is when to push that nuclear button and whether it'll come back to bite your party when you know the shoe's on the other foot later.
Well, I'm paraphrasing Ron Johnson here, but he basically said that when Democrats take control again, they're going to do it. So why be the schmucks who didn't do it first? Again, paraphrasing. It echoes the call from President Trump, which he's reacting to Tuesday, which we'll talk about later in the show, what happened election-wise in Virginia and New Jersey and other elsewhere, saying, okay, we have to get things done. If we want to avoid a bad year in 2026, we need to pass things. He feels like the shutdown is not helping Republicans, so go nuclear option, you know, end the filibuster, open the government, then start passing things. Of course, with Trump, it includes no mail-in voting except for the military, you know, all the other things. Like, he wants these restrictions, all voter ID for every state. You know, it's beyond just the financial stuff, but what he thinks his priorities are. So there is a split in the Senate Republican caucus about what to do, and Ron Johnson has now moved from the no vote to the yes vote in the filibuster, but I don't think it's going to matter a whole lot because John Thune, the leader, is saying we're not doing this. So it's one instance of Republicans at the federal level saying to President Trump, no, we're not going to do what you want to do. Like, you keep saying this, but we're going to protect the institution and this tradition. regardless of what you have to say.
And with all that, again, kind of politicking, one of that those questions that we've had ongoingly is what the pressure point is going to be to get this thing kind of over with. And so there was also this recent announcement about delays in flights and shortages in flights, and we are heading into the holiday season. And so to what extent could that potentially, if this, you know, drags on for another 4 weeks for folks like me who have to get on planes to see their families for Thanksgiving, you know, does that start to also really kind of ramp up that political pressure on all sides of the aisle?
Yeah, and then, you know, the flip side is Democrats did well on Tuesday, so they feel like they've been bolstered by the results. They keep up their tactics of putting pressure on Republicans to extend the subsidies in the Affordable Care Act. So yeah, it's the off ramps we've talked about. Like, they kept being like, oh, once this happens, once the No Kings protests happen, once the election happens, then it'll be over. We keep not, these off ramps keep disappearing. So what is the ultimate one?
Yeah. As I always say, we will see. meanwhile, in Wisconsin, some bills have become law. So there is a little bit of change afoot over here. Three bills were signed last week. One would require school districts to establish policies about banning cell phones during instructional time. One would allow candidates to withdraw from a ballot by a certain time. And then one would allow party chairs to nominate presidential electors under specific circumstances if there's not a candidate for certain offices. It's kind of a wonky election thing. But those first two in particular are really interesting because there was this kind of open question about whether Evers would sign these bills. The cell phone bill was primarily, it had some Democratic support, but it was primarily a GOP bill. And Evers is often kind of loath to weigh in on school curriculum debates. That's often sort of a local jurisdiction matter in his opinion, and so there was a question about that. And then the one about candidates withdrawing from ballots is referred to as the RFK Jr. bill, and so it's kind of a direct response to him trying to get off the ballot last year after he ended his candidacy and endorsed Trump. And so there was, again, this question of whether Democratic Governor Tony Evers is going to sign a bill that would support folks like RFK Jr. or other independent candidates like that. But he did go ahead and sign those.
And the wonky third one, so if you are a political party and have ballot access, like the Greens do, you have to have certain people show up to nominate your electors to be eligible to be one of the people to do that. Under the old law, you had to be an office holder or a candidate for Senate or the Assembly. They didn't have any candidates for the legislature last year, so they didn't have anybody to nominate their electors. So that takes care of that issue. Governor's going to talk about vetoes now. There's going to be an interesting list, especially one about making people come back to work in state government.
Yeah, so to pull those back up, you know, when we talk about how he doesn't necessarily want to weigh in on school issues, one of those bills would have required school boards to make textbooks and curricula available for inspection by local residents. And then the other one would have required state employees to return to work in person. And he signaled pretty loud and clear for months that he would certainly not sign the return to work in person bill. And then to the sort of involvement of local folks looking into, you know, library books and curriculum and things like that, he was also pretty vocal in opposing.
Return to work, Republicans want people back in the office because they feel like we can't be sure that state workers are being efficient with their time serving the public. Evers can't pull off his Vision 2030 if everybody comes back to work. Vision 2030 is a plan for state government's footprint, so obviously pretty big in downtown Madison. We call them the Jeff buildings, Jeff 1, 2, and 3. They've been consolidating people from those three into other state buildings. They want to sell, I believe, two of them. The Department of Health Services is in the first state office building outside the Capitol, built in the 1930s, I believe, historic building. They want to get people out of there. They're consolidating the Tommy G. Thompson Center downtown, and also there's a newish Department of Transportation building out in the west side where people are moving. The whole idea is they can avoid more than $500 million in deferred maintenance on these buildings, cut their cost, reduce their footprint, open up development downtown Madison, win-win. You can't do that if all thousands of these people come back to work every day of the week. So there's a rub, and you know, on the one hand, you think Republicans want to save money. They like it when we have, you know, fewer expenses, but they see us as, if you don't have the capacity to have these people, they're going to keep working from home, and what's that going to mean for us in terms of keeping an eye on them?
One of the arguments, too, that Evers made was that, you know, a return-to-work policy would favor people who live in Milwaukee and Madison, where there are those buildings, and so people who maybe chose to move further away from those kind of hubs, when they could work from home, they would be forced to either relocate to these more expensive cities, and it would kind of pull some of these jobs away from perhaps more rural areas and things like that. But then there's also this question, you know, that the Republicans are trying to make government more efficient, and so the question is also sort sort of to what extent do they want those types of state jobs in their communities versus private industry jobs. And so it's also just a little bit of being at odds over priorities in that way. There were a couple hearings on pieces of legislation this week, including a couple that we pulled out as particularly interesting. So there was an elections committee meeting this week, and there was a proposal to ban drop boxes. This has obviously been a little bit of a Republican priority again since about 2020. So there was a debate about that. And then there was a little bit of news made, which is that, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we went to this press conference where a Democrat and a Republican stood together and they said, we support, you know, certain important reforms to the elections process. We all support Monday processing for absentee ballots. We maybe don't entirely agree on the details, but it's important to show kind of a united front on this particular issue. And then we learned at this committee that there is not enough Republican backing for the Monday processing bill for it to move forward. And so we will start with a little bit of video about that debate right now.
But I also see this job as like a football game. On the Monday process, it's fourth and short, there's 10 minutes left in the game. Right now I'm going to punt. There'll be time to get the ball back later. We're going to have more conversations about it, because it is the single most important reform we could do to elections in the state of Wisconsin that I think, if we can get some more input from the state Senate, I think we can figure out a way to get it done.
The reason that you had Democratic support on these elements in the bill last time is because it was a compromise bill that we were willing to take some of these things that we didn't necessarily like because it had the all-important Monday processing in. We're going to pick apart the parts of this bill in front of us because it doesn't have the part that we like, the part that everybody universally bipartisanly wants, and we're going to talk about it.
Right. So again, this has been a multi-years process, and it just has not gotten over the finish line in terms of trying to give election workers just a little bit more time to start even just opening up absentee ballots and flattening the ballots before they start feeding them into the machines, so that we don't have things like, you know, 3 a.m. wrapping up at Milwaukee at Central Count. But it looks like this is not going to proceed.
So the only way to stop the conspiracy theory that there's a dump early in the morning, the day after the election, that they're fraudulent ballots, is they haven't counted the night of the election and out shortly after the polls close. There's a conspiracy theory preventing the fix for the conspiracy theory to go forward. That conspiracy theory is, if you allow Monday processing, which, let's stress, you cannot count the ballots. You can open them. You can get them ready for going through the machines and feed them in. They cannot be counted. To tell you how labor-intensive processing ballots is, Milwaukee buys machines to open the ballot, open the envelope, and get the ballot. That's how intense it is. But there's this conspiracy theory among some in the Republican base that if you allow this, then clerks in Madison, Milwaukee in particular, will look at the results, or whether at least Ward X is one of your best wards for Democrats in Milwaukee. Ooh, a little light in that, and Ward X, call the local party chair and go, hey, you guys better focus on Ward X tomorrow for same-day voting. That's the theory, that someone's going to get out and, like I said, help Democrats. Now, you can't do that. You're not supposed to do it. But that's the feedback that I hear from Republicans. They go home to their districts and have meetings, and people say, if you guys do that, it's going to be this, this, and this, and it's going to cheat. They're going to cheat. And they don't want the grief back home to vote for that bill, even though they know the only way to stop what's going on, the theory of, like, they're in Milwaukee, they're figuring out how down Republican X is right now to figure out how many ballots they need in Milwaukee, is to have it out early. Florida, by the way, Florida has stuff done like within hours of polls closing. You know how they do that? They start counting right away. Florida is run by, guess who? Republicans. But that doesn't matter because, again, you're talking about swing state Wisconsin, all these distrust of election officials. And let's be honest, there have been some things the last 5 years that people at home go, I'm not sure that looks right, like what's going on. But we're in this, again, in the stuck in limbo of the conspiracy theory stops the conspiracy from being fixed. What do you do?
And it reflects, again, the really specific way that Wisconsin elections are run, where it's extremely decentralized, mm-hmm. and every single municipality has their own, that's not exactly right, but every county clerk, mm-hmm. runs their own thing, and then there are the municipal clerks, and then we also have Central Count. So there's all these kind of very specific ways that Wisconsin runs elections that kind of feed into these conspiracy theories if you don't quite know how that works. And then, of course, Milwaukee being the biggest city with the most people, and it also happens to be disproportionately Democratic as as big cities tend to be. And so it just kind of has fed into this narrative. And then same with the drop boxes as well. This bill to ban drop boxes still also comes out of 2020. And this has also been a much more partisan fight. And so one of the, you know, the debates that came during that committee is, okay, this doesn't actually, Republicans saying this won't affect mail-in ballots and people's ability to cast absentee votes. And Democrats say, well, of course it will. And so again, this fight over, you know, what is the best and safest way to be voting while also kind of ensuring voter access. The other kind of controversial bill this week that we are focusing on is one that would define abortion in state statute. And the idea from the GOP lawmakers is that it would essentially separate out what counts as abortion and what counts as, you know, miscarriage management. Often the same procedures, the same medical procedures are used for terminating a pregnancy as for kind of safely caring for pregnancy loss. And so the Republican authors say essentially this is a way of both reassuring people who are suffering a miscarriage that they are not experiencing an abortion if that is something that is, you know, religiously or personally important to them, but then also would separate out some of the requirements that correspond with abortion access in Wisconsin. It would separate that out from sort of receiving medical care, clear up some fear among medical providers, because certainly in states with other, with stronger restrictions than we have here in Wisconsin, there has been a lot of confusion from medical providers about, am I allowed to provide miscarriage management and health care for that? And so that's kind of the argument behind the bill. And then, of course, Democrats say, well, if you're so worried about being able to provide a full range of holistic health care to women experiencing pregnancy loss, just expand abortion access. And so, of course, it does bring up the abortion debate once again.
Yeah. Just want to point out, too, that Chris Larson in committee was like, look, I'm suspicious of this, essentially. If you're trying to do this, you're trying to open the door to something down the line. Another part of it, politics, of course, is that Republicans get beat up about abortion election time, and there's also this kind of argument of all these horror stories of people who have had a miscarriage or whatnot, and they're not getting care, they say, because the doctor's afraid of, like, this local abortion restriction. So, again, as you dive in those stories, the details sometimes don't match with the public narrative, but there is still a fear out there, and there is a political narrative of they're not just restricting abortion access, but also needed care for women. Ergo, Republicans are bad on this issue, and it hurts them at election time.
Right. And so we actually have a little bit of video of that debate kind of breaking down exactly what we just described, which I will go to now.
I mean, the Supreme Court could change again. You know, Wisconsin's 1849 law comes back, and all of a sudden there's no abortions in the state. I mean, again, it creates clarity. No matter what else is on the books, it's making it crystal clear that women who have to suffer through a miscarriage can get the medical care they need, regardless of what our policy is on abortion, because getting that care is not an abortion. So I would think we'd want that clarity, regardless of what our state statutes are in the book in terms of when we want to allow the ending of a pregnancy.
I mean, I appreciate that you guys are you're admitting that you're putting this forward because you're trying to outlaw a certain portion of abortion.
This doesn't outlaw
anything.
This
doesn't outlaw any abortion.
I would encourage you to read the bill. It doesn't outlaw abortion. And there's no restrictions.
If you are trying to define it, what is the purpose? What does this help down the road other than to be able to say that you're trying to clarify, if not to take an additional step to otherwise restrict access to certain types of health care?
Yeah, so again, I don't know that that bill is necessarily going to move forward, and it doesn't seem like the kind of thing that even if it does, Tony Evers would sign off on. But as you say, we are heading into an election year, and so these are the types of issues that get voters to the polls. Mm-hmm. Also this week, the Supreme Court elected to hear a case. They haven't set any type of dates or anything like that, but they've agreed that they will hear a case that looks into a minority retention grant program that's existed in Wisconsin since the 80s. It was found unconstitutional by an appeals court earlier this year. So this is essentially a program that provided state funds to students from certain backgrounds, Black, Hispanic, American Indian, and some Southeast Asian students. And then after the Supreme Court 2 years ago ruled that race cannot be used as a factor in admissions, this was brought forward as essentially discriminating against students who do not fall into those racial categories. As the appeals court agreed in February, this judge said that a financially needy student who is not a member of one of the preferred groups can do nothing to overcome the race, national origin, ancestry, and alienage discrimination intentionally built into the grant program. So these kind of strong words about what it means to be sort of racially qualified for an education-related program. And so the Supreme Court has taken this up, I think, this is my sort of speculation after speaking to lawyers, in part because the way that this appeals court ruled, this would apply very, very broadly to say essentially race-based anything and anything run by the state would not be appropriate under this U.S. Supreme Court case. And so it'll be interesting to see how sort of narrowly or broadly the liberal justices on the Supreme Court rule and what that means for kind of race-based programs that the state runs even outside of the educational system. So just a really interesting case that they picked up on. And again, we have sort of no dates, but we will be kind of keeping an eye on that. This brings us to the stock report, and I've been trying to come up with a pun for the rising, which is the livestock industry.
So look, DAC, Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection, back in the summer, put out a proposed series of fee increases on livestock, like people who have places that do livestock trades, okay? Some of the increases were going to be 1,700%. That's right, 1,700%. Mass, like, blowback from the livestock industry, like, this is not good, impact truckers, all kinds of other folks. So DATCAP this week said, we're going to back off that. We've heard you, essentially. We're going to now change. Now, it's still going to be an increase of, like, inflationary increase, which, back in the napkin math, is about 50 to 60%. These fees have been increased since 2008, I believe, so it's still going to be a higher bill, but that pales in comparison to the sticker shock of 1,700%. So now the question I have going forward, okay, what's it going to look like? Because DATCAP said we'll have a new fee proposal for the board to weigh in on. And two, we see legislation that would maybe fund these programs better to decrease the need for fee increase. Because remember, the fees are supposed to cover the cost of these programs for inspections, those kinds of things. The agency is saying we don't have enough money to cover our costs. If we don't have the money, we have to go get fees to cover these costs. So this debate's not done yet, but it's a big relief for livestock industry to say, okay, it's not going to be huge, it's going to be large.
And then mixed, we have the election that everybody is on the edge of their seats for, the GOP lieutenant governor's field.
Well, we got to five candidates now who want to be lieutenant governor on the Republican side. That's kind of impressive. Only one for Democrats, still Sarah Galuski. On the Republican side, his name's Nick Pulci, I think I'm saying it correctly. He ran against Brian Stile in 2018 for the GOP nomination when Paul Ryan stepped down, said, I'm not going to run again. Like a four or five-way primary, he ran. He's back. Will Martin's in the race. He ran for the governor 2 years or 3 years ago. David Varnum, former Lancaster mayor, also ran again, ran 2022's end. So the field is growing. My question, though, is Will Martin the guy to watch? So if you go back to 2022, it was kind of a matter of resources, an eight-person race. And Roger Roth, who was a state senator at the time, he came into the race with $400,000 in his war chest. He dropped like $350,000 in the pre-primary period on TV and radio. He got boosted by an outside group to $150,000. Pat Testin, also state senator, spent $34,000 on everything in the pre-primary period. So Roger had all the bucks. Roger won the nomination, got the ticket to Tim Michaels, they lost. Okay. Martin finished like around fifth or sixth, you know, like ninth of the vote. But since then, he's been doing all these like Republican dinners and events. He's been very involved. He's more active on social media. People see him as the kind of the obvious one who's going to do well in this race, if you assume from like being engaged with grassroots. But, there's always a but, if somebody comes in and says, I want to spend $500,000 of my own money to be lieutenant governor, I'm just throwing it out there, that could change the dynamic dramatically, right? Because how much do these guys have for resources? So keep an eye on that. But Will Martin looks like the favorite right now. But does somebody else get in that has a big checkbook and wants to really be lieutenant governor really, really badly?
Well, and that brings us to the falling, which is the Republican Party as a whole. They had a bit of a bad night on Tuesday.
So obvious caveats apply. It's an off year. It's New Jersey and Virginia, the governor's races. But it's not just New Jersey and Virginia. It's also Georgia. The Republic Service Commission flipped two seats for Democrats. Of the 159 counties in Georgia, all but two went more Democratic than they were the fall of 24. Okay, there's something there. Virginia, not a great apples-to-apples comparison because you had a flawed candidate, top of the ticket for governor, got outspent vastly. New Jersey, though, that's kind of an interesting one. Trump closed that gap to like five or six points in November. I mean, Jersey's pretty blue, but he got close. And there's a thought that you might see the coalition that Trump built show up on Tuesday and make that a close race. There was a lot of polls going into Tuesday that said it was neck and neck. She won by 12 points, roughly. So that whole theory blew apart. And if you dive in the numbers, the Trump coalition fell apart. Hispanics, for example, there are a couple of counties that are kind of key in New Jersey that are like 40-50% Hispanic. They went to Trump or went swung from going for Trump to going back Democratic by a bigger margin significantly. Okay, bad sign. New York mayor, you can't really apply that. It's New York, you know, it's not really applying here to Wisconsin. However, you see the energy and the message of affordability. And that's what kind of came across in my conversations this week of there's an affordability issue for Republicans because Donald Trump ran a year ago saying, I'm going to cut costs, not bring inflation to a normal level like he's saying now, but I'm going to cut costs. I remember he went to Western Wisconsin a year and 2 months ago and said, I'm going to cut your energy bill in half my first year as president. That's not going to happen by January. So how do Republicans address this? The president is saying, I don't want to hear about the affordability issue. He actually said this yesterday. I don't want to hear affordability. And he ticked off all these costs that are down, which is true. I mean, eggs are less expensive than they were when he got in office. Gas is less expensive. Beef is up, though, and your grocery bills are still high. People don't feel what he is selling. That is one of Joe Biden's problems in 2023, where he was telling people, it's getting better. And they said, no, it's not. I don't feel it at home. So in talking to people on both sides of the aisle, Republicans said we have to message it better and get our hands wrapped around the inflation thing. Yes, maybe it's not fair to expect a president to change everything about the economy in a year. Well, let me separate it. The economy is not the same as affordability, okay? Change the affordability issue in a year. Because the economy, look at your 401k, stock market, doing great. That's not what most people look at. They look at, what are my bills doing? Can I afford a home right now? What are mortgage rates doing? They don't feel it. For Democrats, they have to say, I have an answer for you. Because Democrats are viewed as out of touch. It's really a weird dynamic where Democrats, the brand is in the toilet. They did great on Tuesday. So how does that happen? Well, Donald Trump creates a higher floor for Democrats than what Republicans have. Because we've talked this ad nauseum. The Trump voters not turning out unless Trump's in the ballot. So for Republicans, can you get your floor to where Democrats are because they're a higher floor? And oh, by the way, Trump like is like jet fuel for them. Again, 12 points in Jersey, like that should tell you something. Now, the cautions are, we're a year away from Wisconsin. We are purple Wisconsin. Candidates matter, resources matter. So I'm not gonna sit here and say, because Democrats said X, Y, and Z on Tuesday in these other states, it means this for Wisconsin November of 26. But if you're a Democrat, don't you feel better than a Republican right now? Because you go, okay, I've got a pissed off electorate. I've got Donald Trump saying stuff like, I don't hear about affordability. And I've got resources as an advantage because we know the parties, right? The Democratic Party of Wisconsin is a better Republican Party. I'd feel better if I can message this thing the right way and show that I'm connected and I have an answer for voters come next fall.
Yeah, and so we'll continue to kind of trace how that messaging plays out and also the enthusiasm. I definitely got a lot of excited texts from Democratic sources this week and a lot of kind of disappointed texts from Republicans. And so I think those feelings also from the political side, you know, kind of also motivate the messaging. So really interesting to pay attention to. And in the meantime, I am Ani Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Thanks for watching Rewind.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.